Good afternoon, members of the court. My name is Victor Boog, attorney number 2561, appearing on behalf of the appellant, Marion Stanton. As you're aware, this is a case challenging an award of attorney fees made by a trial court judge in a lengthy trial up in Boulder. Interesting thing about this is that the hearings on attorney fees were conducted in March of 2009 for an hour or two on three separate days, and the decision on the award of attorney fees was not made until September 30th, the last day of the trial judge's tenure before retirement. And that was done, I think, at the request of the opposing counsel, who recognized that if he was going to get a decision, he had to get it soon or there wouldn't be one. It might even be deemed denied. So we're here, and the question is, what was awarded? $518,500, more or less. And what did that entail? Well, there was a claim for attorney fees under the groundless and frivolous statute, under which was awarded, I think, $295,000.
They all awarded from Ms. Stanton?
Excuse me?
Were they all awarded against your client, or was part of it awarded from the trust itself?
No, this is all against my client. In fact, the $518,500 is all against my client. There were awards of fees against the fiduciary fees in favor of the plaintiff, the petitioner, towards the trust assets, but this was a separate award against my client. The interesting thing is that normally when you have an award of attorney fees and you have multiple issues in a case, there has to be a tribute, how much was on this issue, how much was that on that issue. When this case went to trial, the petitioner had 35 issues listed for trial. My client, who I didn't represent at trial, had 33 of her own. The trial addressed innumerable issues. Some of those issues were found in favor of the petitioner. Some were found in favor of my client, and at least one issue was found in favor of my client on appeal.
Mr. Boog?
Yes.
Is it a fair statement that all of the claims of liability which your client had were based in part upon the defendant's the petitioner's position as a fiduciary?
Not entirely. One of the claims the petitioner made was she wanted rent from her mother for about 8 years prior to the filing of this case. And she wanted it as a landlady. She owned the house. She'd acquired it from her mother about 8 years earlier. During her mother's lifetime, she'd never asked for rent, and she'd been receiving substantial gifts, some over $10,000. But she came to trial and asked for rent for all that time, and she had only become a fiduciary as a trustee of her mother's estate in about 2003.
I'm talking about the claims that your client had against her.
Okay. One of the claims, the only claims that my client had against her was she wanted an accounting, as a trustee should give, as a fiduciary. She asked for it for the period in question. In fact, 2 days after this case was filed, the case was filed on May 18th, 2005, and on May 20th, 2005, there was a stipulation as to the issues that were allegedly imperative to decide right away. There was a stipulation that mother would have certain medical care, it would be paid for out of the trust or other appropriate resources, and that the care provider, one of the care providers, the boyfriend of the petitioner, would be paid monies at a certain rate. And the things that were left open were, was she really entitled to rent for 8 years past when there's a statute of limitations and there was no request for rent before that, no agreement to pay it. My client wanted accounting. She'd never have accounting of this trust, which had been in effect from 2003. And there was a stipulation that such an accounting would be rendered. So when this case started, it was a pretty everyday case. And subsequently, in the first year, there was an issue about whether or not Mrs. Mikovic should have independent counsel which the court deemed appropriate, whether it should be a guardian ad litem appointed, which the court deemed appropriate, and those things took place. And in fact, until 2007, in January 2007, when Mr. Greshler withdrew as her attorney, one other attorney having withdrawn earlier, the only things that had been addressed at that time were responses to the guardian ad litem's report, which was very damning of the petitioner and had a lot of concerns about what had gone on in her capacity as trustee and otherwise. This issue about groundless and frivolous stuff, in my opinion, there's very limited issues that could potentially fall in that category. And none of them in the early case fall in that category at all.
Mr. Boog, if I can ask you a question here, I'll be candid. I have a little trouble on with your argument on the merits for overturning frivolous and groundless when we have a district court finding that it's the most frivolous case he'd ever seen in his career. I think you're probably on stronger ground on your allocation argument, but I'm willing to hear you. So I really have two questions on the frivolous and groundless piece or the 13-17-102 piece. I would be interested to hear how you think we can, how do we overcome the district court's finding that, it's the most frivolous case he'd ever seen? And then let me ask you that one first, and then I'll ask about allocation.
If you look at the record in this case, the transcript of the evidence, the pleadings, it's one of these decisions like the attorney who came in and was the first attorney for Mrs. Weidman came in at the attorney fee hearing and said, I believe all this money that was spent was all the responsibility of my client. And I then started talking to her about specifics in the record. Why was having a guardian ad litem appointed grounds and frivolous? She had to concede that it wasn't. So we went through this exercise for a few minutes, and the trial judge then looks at me and says, Mr. Boog, we only have an hour for this matter. You've got four more minutes. And he says, I understand that the witness who says all this is your client's responsibility has gone through every pleading now for the first 6 months or more of this case and conceded that there was nothing groundless or frivolous about it. And yet I know that she's going to say the whole case is groundless. So I get your point. Move on. That was the judge that tried this case. That's the judge who said this was the most groundless and frivolous case he'd ever seen. How groundless and frivolous was it for my client to challenge a claim that was made in July of 2007, almost 2.5 years after this case was filed, when they said against my client, gee, mom and dad gave you about $13,000, $14,000 in 1973 as a part down payment on a house. We think that was a loan. We don't have any loan documents, but take our word for it, it was a loan. In 1983 or so, mom and dad helped pay off the mortgage on that house. We think that was a loan. We don't think that there's any statute of limitations here. Then mom, who, when this money was advanced, became a joint tenant on this property before dad's death, conveys by quitclaim the house to my client. That was alleged to be under duress. Well, there was no evidence of that, and there was no finding of that by the trial judge. And the trial judge at trial says, well, yeah, these are old amounts for a long time ago, and Mrs. Mikovic, he found to be competent financially until almost her death in 2005. But yet, he said, no statute of limitations, and the judgment for that amount was over $300,000. And he says this is a groundless and frivolous case. It was groundless and frivolous, in my opinion, when somebody sues for and gets an award for $300,000, and there's not even a statute of limitations. There's just ignore any gifts, presumptions of gifts. And this case was not groundless and frivolous in its entirety at all.
Great argument, if I can interrupt. And let me remind you, Mr. Boog, I know you're a good trial lawyer. If you'd stay by that microphone so we can record you, no problem. What the court found as groundless and frivolous was your client's claims, correct? So the fees were for the petitioners having to defend. Is that right?
the fees that the petitioner paid were not in defense.
That's where I'm going. But what the court found frivolous and groundless were the claims your client made, correct?
That's what the judge said.
All right. So now you raise an issue about allocation.
Yes.
Right. Okay.
Yes.
The court did, I mean, I recognize you dispute this to the end of the earth, but the petitioner said, I think 80% were for my defense, of the fees were for my defense of your claims. Is that not evidence we could rely on? If not, why not?
Because it's not competent. This petitioner says 80% of Gressler's fees or 95% of Gressler's fees were defending my fiduciary fees. Gressler, that issue wasn't even introduced into this case until July of 07. Gressler was 6 months out of the picture. She says 80%, 90%, 95% of Gressler's fees are defending my fiduciary fees. She hadn't even asked for fiduciary fees. Why? Because she was on Social Security disability, and if she had gotten them, she'd have lost her disability. So she came in with this rent theory. That I'm entitled to rent for the last 8 years on the property that mom is living in that once owned. The same was true with the fees for...
Why is it not competent evidence? You know, it's for the judge to determine whether or not to assess it's credible or not, but why wouldn't it be competent evidence?
It's...
Are you saying she can't, she's not... Who is able to give evidence about the allocation to the different claims?
What did she admit on cross-examination as to all these fees and costs? Let's go to Mr. Hollingman's bill, the biggest one. This bill, $277,000, the court awarded $221,000 based on Ms. Weidman's 80% number. When asked whether she'd attempt to determine from Hollingman's invoices the costs incurred, I have not delineated what to assess. I have not gone through as to identify which billings related to which claim. And she couldn't, and I couldn't. $173,000 of those bills were blacked out. You can't tell what they were for. And Mr. Hollingman represented him on her on more than this case. There was a separate case involving the probate part of the case. Probate issues, separate. There weren't separate billings, you can't tell. $173,000 of Mr. Hollingman's bills, and you can't tell anything about what they were for. She couldn't. She said, when I asked her how she came up with 80%, she said, well, from the hip, sir. If you want me to give me 6 months, I can do it item by item. This is after she was trying to be rehabilitated on a second hearing date, because on the first hearing date, she didn't have any clue of anything. And when I said, how is the court supposed to determine how much time Hollingman spent on tasks for which Ms. Stanton might be responsible? She responded, I think you're trying to dissect something that can't be dissected. That's her competent evidence. That's the evidence this court relied upon to grant this award. There wasn't any competent evidence, and the thing that offends me as the trial lawyer most of all is I know that if there's any competent evidence in the record to support a decision, you affirm it. But I think from my experience in the Court of Appeals, unfortunately, it's all too often that you allow not even a shred of competent evidence to support an award, and this is a case like that. We have somebody gets up and says, the whole thing is Ms. Stan's responsibility. And when I ask the attorney the specific questions, she says, well, no, that wasn't. No, that wasn't. And we go through that for 4 or 5 minutes, and the judge says, I get your point, Mr. Boog, move on. When you look at this record on what was awarded here, there's no justification for literally any of it. And Ms. Weidman, she wasn't a lawyer. She didn't even know. She couldn't testify at reasonable or necessity, and nobody else did. Mr. Hollingman, at these hearings, he didn't bring in an attorney who said, I've looked at his billings, and I think they're appropriate, and I think they're related to this claim or that claim. There was no attempt to allocate anything. It was just, here it is, take 80% and fly with it. And the 80% was indefensible. When you look at the record in this case, and I looked at it, and I know you guys don't want to be accountants and look through 2,300 pages of trial transcript, 100 of which had anything to do with financial matters. But that's the bottom line. And if this court had done that, it's indefensible what happened here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Boog. Charlamagne?
My name is Kirk Holloman, number 8325 for the appellee, Carolyn Weidman. In that first judgment, in the underlying case on the merits, the judge made many findings of fact that are relevant to the fees hearing that happened later, which were not appealed by Ms. Stanton in her first appeal of the underlying judgment. At the time the briefing was completed in this case, the Supreme Court had not denied the writ of certiorari petition filed by Ms. Stanton, but on about October 18, 2010, it did. And so all of those findings of fact that were not appealed from, that are relevant to this hearing, must be accepted as true. The appellant is collaterally stopped from challenging those findings of fact and attempting to relitigate.
Well, let me ask you, are they collaterally stopped from that, or is it simply a law of the case issue for which basically it would be a court's discretion to reconsider, its prior rulings?
I think at the time the brief was filed, it was a law of the case issue, because under Colorado law, until the Supreme Court has denied cert, you don't have a collateral estoppel or res judicata. But I think as of the time the Supreme Court denied cert, which was about a month after the last brief in this case was filed, it did become, as a matter of law, issue preclusion or collateral estoppel. And Judge Sands had made many findings that weren't appealed that relate to this, including
those findings contravened by the evidence at the fees hearing?
I don't believe they were. The testimony of Martha Ridgway, the expert witness, was that these claims were frivolous and groundless, that the whole course of conduct by the Ms. Stanton was frivolous and groundless.
That opposing counsel just ended by saying, well, Ms. Ridgway admitted, well, maybe this wasn't frivolous and groundless, and maybe this wasn't frivolous and groundless.
She said maybe one or two paragraphs here or there, one or two pleadings might have been with merit, but the overall entire course of conduct of Ms. Stanton from the filing of the emergency petition onward was prevent Ms. Weidman from obtaining compensation, and it was the worst case she had ever seen.
And I understand that one of the findings was that the litigation was pursued in bad faith.
Yes, that was one of the findings by the trial court in the fees hearing. In both the underlying case and in the fees hearing, the court found these were cases or claims that lacked substantial justification, that there was an expansion of the proceedings, and that the Ms. Stanton had interposed all of her claims for harassment. And the facts in the record, both in the underlying judgment and going into the fees hearing, demonstrate a course of conduct that fully supports the trial court's finding that all of these all of these claims were interposed for purposes of harassment.
Well, it may fully support the trial court's findings that there's harassment and bad faith and everything, but how does that help us allocate reasonable and necessary attorney fees necessary or allowable for litigating those claims?
Well, I think under the Padilla case, this is a case where everything is intertwined. From the very beginning, from the filing of the first response to the emergency petition, Ms. Stanton was contesting fees. She was doing everything she could to make it difficult for Ms. Weidman. The trial court found in the fees hearing that from the filing of the respondent's initial pleading in response to the emergency petition that initiated this matter and onward throughout the course of the matter, The respondent aggressively asserted her claims in a manner so as to require the petitioner to defend the fees, expenses, and costs that had been incurred and that were proposed to be incurred by the petitioner in her capacity as a fiduciary. Indeed, the emergency petition sought approval of fees, costs, and expenses that had been incurred and were to be incurred in the future by Ms. Wideman in her fiduciary capacity. And a review of the pleadings and motions filed thereafter demonstrate that everything filed thereafter by Ms. Stanton for which fees are sought constituted a direct or indirect attack on these fees, expenses, and costs.
Well, let's break that up, Mr. Holloman. I'll be very candid. I have a lot of concerns about this. Below, it seems to me, the affidavits painted with an extremely broad brush. You use words like inextricably intertwined. Well, Padilla, that phrase happens in a quotation from the trial court. There's not a lot of help in that case to guide me, at least. Dubray is the other one you rely on. That case was personal jurisdiction. The court said you would have spent the same money regardless. So if I can, I'd like to focus on the specific issues. Let's take first frivolous and groundless, all right, the 1317-102 fees. The allocation here was based on your client's statement that 80% really went to my defense against Ms. Stanton's fees. As Mr. Boob said, she said, "I was shooting from the hip," and he quoted the record exactly. How could a trial court rely on that in practice, I did plenty of these hearings. You usually put up a witness who went through all the bills and said, here's what applies to this and here's what applies to that. I think the only thing we have to allocate is your client's statement that 80%, I think it's 80% and I'm shooting from the hip. How can we rely on that?
Well, that wasn't the entire testimony by Ms.
True. She said, "I couldn't go through it because Mr. Boo quoted it."
Well, she also stated that she spent 6 hours reviewing all the invoices, that she was very familiar with these invoices. She lived this case for years. She paid all the bills. She reviewed all the invoices.
But how did she allocate? How did she say what applies to her claims versus her defending against Ms. Stanton's claims?
She knew that most of the time and effort was taken defending against all of these allegations that Ms. Stanton had made, and the trial court went through them in the first judgment, said they were all without merit. You had claims about Social Security disability income, accountings going back to 1989 for somebody that became a trustee in 2003. I could go on and on, but she had a basis for making these allocations based on her knowledge of the facts of the case or payment of these bills. There was no evidence presented to the contrary, and indeed, the expert witness confirmed that all of these fees flowed from Stanton's contesting of the initial petition and all the way through. At the very beginning, after the petition was filed, Ms. Stanton met with Ms. Wideman and said to her, "You'll just have to learn the hard way." And then after that, she let loose with all of these claims. On and on it went. And it's quite clear when she said, "You'll have to learn the hard way," she was doing all of this to harass Ms. Wideman. Under the statute, a claim can be interposed for harassment, and it might have legally colorable merit, but if it's interposed for harassment, as the trial court found, it is still a basis for the award of fees. And everything Ms. Stanton did after the filing of that petition was done for harassment.
And I understand that. I understand your position. But your client also had a bunch of claims herself. And the court did not award fees for your pursuing your own claims, correct?
That's where Ms. Wideman had allocated the 20% that was not spent in defending against Ms. Stanton's claims.
And so your argument would be it's sufficient for her or any witness, and I tend to agree with you. As the person paying the bills, I think she's competent, and I frankly tend to agree with that. But you think it's sufficient for her just to say, "I'm shooting from the hip, and that's okay"?
Well,
how does the other side defend against that?
Well, Mr. Boog was leading her, and that was a sarcastic reply by Ms. Wideman. He said, "You're just doing something." She said, "No, from the hip, sir." But she did give a basis for having made that allocation. I mean, all of these fees happened after the emergency petition was filed. None of these fees that were awarded related to any expert witnesses, any fiduciary services, or anything before that petition was filed. So all of this was the result of Ms. Weidman not wanting to let her mother's money that she controlled loose to pay for the care of her own mother. Her own mother had to write her twice asking her to release those funds. She refused. It was necessary as a result when her mother was faced with a operation to amputate her remaining leg. Ms. Weidman was forced to go to court to get approval of this care plan. Yes, the compensation was sought in the form of rental reimbursement, a cost. There were concerns about the impact on Ms. Weidman's disability income. If she lost that, she wouldn't have been able to take care of her mother. She had no ability to work. She was having to take care of a woman with one leg from 2003 onward. So all of this was done to hassle and harass Ms. Weidman. Ms. Stanton went and hassled the caregivers, as the trial court noted. It goes on and on with the activity of Ms. Stanton. The total course of conduct here of harassment, bad faith throughout, even starting before the petition was filed, you had this conduct.
Tom, can I ask you another question because your time is limited? I would like, if you would, to respond to Mr. Boog's argument about your invoices. I have them, and I confess I have some concern. I'll read the first entry. Read correspondence of 1-5 from Carol regarding crossout. Review crossout. Respond to Carol regarding crossout. Review crossout. Correspondence to Carol regarding crossout. And there's a whole bunch like that. In terms of allocation, how are we to know whether these entries dealt with your claims versus the defenses?
These were redacted for privilege purposes.
I understand.
And you might not be able to tell that. Ms. Weidman, though, was familiar with them. These invoices and the other ones from Mr. Gresham were provided 6 months in advance at the time the fee petition was filed for my invoices, and the Gresham invoices were exhibits during the trial on the merits.
But my question to you is, I understand, and I fully respect the privilege issue you're raising, but my question is, how is the other side to respond to a contention that these deal with their defenses, their claims, as opposed to your claims?
They had them for at least six months. They didn't undertake any discovery. They didn't file a motion with Judge Sandstead asking that the invoices be reviewed perhaps in camera or contesting the redaction for privilege. They did nothing until the time of the hearing and raised this issue there. As far as the guardian ad litem, that was brought up never at the fees hearing, not in the trial on the merits. It was raised for the first time on appeal. And the reports of the guardian ad litem and the guardian were not offered into evidence. Neither of those two people testified. They weren't offered at either the trial on the merits or the fees hearing. But as far as the allocation goes, I think there's sufficient evidence on the record to support the award of 100% of everything that happened from the filing of this petition on. And when the trial court awarded 80 or 90 based upon the various categories, I think that that was less than 100. It was the respondent or appellant benefited. But the evidence in the record is so overwhelming that everything she did was for harassment and bad faith that the trial court could have, with record support, awarded everything against Ms. Stanton from the filing of that petition onward.
Okay, and I apologize for monopolizing your time, Mr. Holloman. Obviously, I have questions, and I appreciate your willingness to help me. I'd like to turn briefly in the minute you have to the 15, 14, 417 fees argument. Do you agree that those relate to only the fiduciary's cost, her own fees?
Fees and costs.
Right, but it's the fiduciary's own expenses, not lawyer fees. They're right. It's what the fiduciary spent.
No, I believe it relates to attorney's fees paid by the fiduciary.
Okay. Right, for the fiduciaries, it's the defense of the fiduciaries' own fees and costs, I thought. I thought that's what the statute says.
It's the costs and fees incurred in defending the fiduciary's right.
A challenge, right. Thank you. That, well said. All right. Now, I know Ms. Ridgway testified all of this went to that. I think Mr. Boog says this issue didn't even come up till the trial. There was no claim for fiduciary costs and fees till very late. Is that true?
No, it's not. In the emergency petition, the claim was made for the rental reimbursement as opposed to compensation in the form of payments. The appellant recognized that in the response where she said that the petitioner was trying to get compensation for trustee services. There was a another document filed by the appellant in a year later where she said, I contested the right to fees in my first response to the petition. I contested the right to fiduciary fees. That's set forth in the brief.
Thank you, Mr. Allman. I very much appreciate your patience with me in particular. We thank both counsel for your briefs and arguments in this case. They're helpful to the court. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will be issued in due course.